Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of our good friend, Dr. Russell Blaylock. And we talked to him perhaps 2 weeks ago about certain books and research he'd done going into this whole idea of the molecular control of the personality. In other words, basically engineering people and gaining control of the molecular structure of human beings so that you can alter human beings and really almost engineer them. And this seems really pretty far out, and yet there have been people around for the better part of a century who don't look upon human beings as unique creation made in the image and likeness of God, but as rather something that has been molded and created and destroyed if necessary as we move to create a different type of superior race, the new individual perhaps that President Obama refers to. The new individual, can we really engineer a new individual? Well, or do we want to? Is that our obligation? Where does God fit into the equation? Well, for that as a background, our guest is Dr. Russell Blaylock. Russell, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Well, why don't you go ahead and pick up the story where we left on?
Well, when we talked last time, I was discussing the Rockefeller influence and what we call social control, social engineering. And these were terms that his group of scientists had worked out. And he used this term continuously in this early literature. Now, we're talking about going back to the 1800s, about 1885 through 1901 through 1907. So he was establishing all of this at the time, and he formed the General Education Board with the idea that he would slowly take over the educational system of the United States, which he eventually did. And I went through the mechanism by which he did this. Well, one of the things that was heavily funded by Rockefeller Foundation, mainly John D. Rockefeller Jr., was eugenics. And while the Rockefeller Foundation itself didn't primarily fund it, they did it through the Carnegie Foundation. And Carnegie worked with John D. Rockefeller to merge their two foundations. And many of the trustees and presidents of the Carnegie Foundation have come from the Rockefeller Foundation. So they were heavily involved in this eugenics movement. Well, there's an excellent book I would encourage people that are interested to read called War Against the Weak. Most of us have heard of eugenics, but, you know, I didn't know a lot of the details of the eugenic movement until I read this book. In this book, it's a very intensive research that was done by the author of the book, and they went through over 50,000 documents. They went through the archives of four countries, looking at what went on during the period of the eugenics movement that was funded by these foundations. And what he found was, of course, Galton, a German, coined the term eugenics in 1883, and then it traveled to the United States. Well, he had a tremendous influence on the social scientists that were under the employ of and control of the Rockefeller Foundation. And so they saw that what was happening in the United States, if they didn't gain control, was that what they classified the unfit would out-reproduce what they considered the elite.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, Russell, go right ahead with the story. So basically, they feared that the inferior people would outproduce or reproduce the superior people, and so they were going to have to intervene. So what did they elect to do here? Was this during the early years of the 20th century?
Yes, this is starting about 1907 to 1910 is when it really began to build into a powerful movement. And by the 1920s, it had gripped most of the educational institutions in the United States. One of the people who was in the eugenics record office and the American Eugenics Society as a trustee was Alexander Graham Bell. So they had a lot of prestigious names. They had presidents of Harvard University, major scientists University of Chicago, Caltech, who were driving forces behind this eugenics. People in the American Medical Association formed a whole section just on eugenics. They had the leading ophthalmologist in the United States at that time, Dr. Howe, who was the one who started putting the sodium nitrate eye drops in babies to prevent venereal disease destroying the eye. He was an obsessed eugenicist. All of these people were organized under the sub-organizations created by the Rockefeller Foundation. And as you read through this book, you see just how powerful this became and the sort of things that they were planning. For instance, the leader of the group was Charles Davenport, who was a confidant of John D. Rockefeller, Jr., and he dominated eugenics for decades. He was made by the Carnegie Foundation the head of the whole eugenics section, and they created what was called Cold Springs Harbor, which those in science know is a very famous research laboratory even today. Well, it was started as a institute to study the evolution of man with the idea of eugenic control of populations. This is just a quote from Charles Davenport, who is a very dangerous person. He said, "Society must protect itself as it claims the right to deprive the murderer of his life so it may annihilate the hideous serpent of hopelessly vicarious protoplasm." They referred constantly...
Hold that thought. Russell will be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Grace Russell is talking about how there were these groups of people, and we're talking the period 1907, around that area, and after, a little after that. And these people were largely financed by the Rockefeller foundations of one form or another, Rockefeller organizations. And they really, of course, believed that we had a superior race, and then we had a lot of inferior people. And how are we going to deal with the inferior races? And but they didn't talk about them as human beings. They referred to them as protoplasm, things of that sort. Now, it's very hard for people today to understand the mentality that existed, but many of these people were in key positions in the universities and medicine, and they, as an elitist, of course, were looking for a rational solution to the problems of population, specifically the population and the growing population of inferior human beings. Now, these are the ideas you might expect coming out of a concentration camp in Hitler's Germany. But these ideas, of course, were here in the United States. They were gaining gaining backing during this era. And many of the intellectuals of that era were really planning on how we could engineer an entirely different society. So pick up the story, Russell.
As we're saying, they referred to these people as human weeds, as scum, the worst terms you could imagine. Well, and most people today, when you mention eugenics, they think, well, someone who is severely mentally retarded, you sterilize them so that they won't have children that are severely mentally retarded, etc. Well, when we look at the actual record of what went on during that period, they considered unfit just someone who was shiftless, if they weren't motivated, if they didn't have the same drive that the Rockefellers had, they were considered unfit for life. And it's interesting when you look at Margaret Sanger's work. One of the studies she quoted was a study done by the U.S. Army Intelligence Testing, and they asserted that 70% of Americans were feeble-minded. Well, she said, you know, we need to get rid of them. And she said, we nourish the unfit and criminal, and instead we should exterminate them. Nature eliminates the weeds, but we turn them into parasites and allow them to reproduce. At Caltech, one of our major institutions of learning, they created the Human Betterment Society, which Davenport was a big part of, the very man who was referring to people as human weeds. And they were even suggesting that, like bacteria, these undesirables should be starved to death. And some of the notables of history, some of the quotes I found were just unbelievable, like Oliver Wendell Holmes had these comments. He told Harold Latsky, who was a socialist from England, he said, in cases of the difference between oneself and another, there's nothing to do except in unimportant matters to think ill of him, and in important matters to kill him. And he said, the principle that sustains compulsory vaccinations is broad enough to cover cutting the fallopian tubes. So if we could force vaccinate people, we can force sterilize people. Well, this became so obsessive in the United States, and it had taken over so many, you know, took over the public health departments, took over major universities. The Human Betterment Society became very powerful in the United States. The newspapers and magazines were supporting this eugenic movement, and they even called for hunting these people down. They, you know, one of the things Davenport wanted to do is create huge data banks, look through the pedigree of people and assign them numbers so that you would know anyone who had any sort of physical weakness, mental weakness, so that they could be eliminated. And these massive data banks were being proposed. Well, during this period, some 35,000 people were forcibly sterilized and castrated. In California alone, they sterilized some 14,500 people. Now, the real impetus of this was a story that he told of Carrie Buck. This was a girl who was born to a woman who was sort of ne'er-do-well, and she had been arrested and placed in a compound. And what people today don't realize is that many of these people were forcibly put in compounds, what today we'd call labor camps, and they were kept there against their will. Well, her mother died in one of these labor camps for the unfit, and so then they went after Carrie Buck, the daughter, and they said, well, she needs to be forcibly sterilized as well and placed in the same labor camp. Well, actually, one of the eugenicists that was high in the eugenics world was so outraged by this, he took her case and brought it all the way to the Supreme Court, in which the major decision was written by Oliver Wendell Holmes, and she lost, and so they put her in this labor camp and forcibly sterilized her. Well, unfortunately for them, she had a baby before they could sterilize her. And so then they went after the baby. Well, the baby was only 2 years old, so Davenport insisted that the baby be evaluated to see if it's feeble-minded. And so they had the social worker evaluate the baby, and the social worker said, well, it's only 2 months old. How can I determine feeble-mindedness in this baby? And hello?
Go right ahead.
Okay. And so they decided that they were going to incarcerate this child and declare the child feeble-minded. Well, it ended up the child lived to age 9, had honors scores in school, and was doing very well. But they were going to sterilized this child if it got old enough, but it contracted a disease and died. But this was the beginning of the real push. Now, after this Kerry Buck Supreme Court case, in which they were allowed to forcibly incarcerate a person in a labor camp and sterilize them, they did the greatest number of sterilizations. Over 30,000 occurred after that point. And Oliver Wendell Holmes was saying that this is absolutely necessary for the safety of mankind. We've got to destroy these people, which Margaret Sanger had already said, well, we have scientific proof. 70% of the American public comes under this designation of unfit for life. They're feeble-minded. We're talking about a huge number of people they were planning to sterilize. Well, the interesting thing about this is it became such a fevered obsession among the intellectuals and the academians that the Europeans, Galton himself, who started the whole idea of eugenics, he was shocked at the Americans. He said, you know, they're carrying it far beyond what I ever dreamed. And that they're using the power of government and the courts to do this. Well, just to give you an example, this guy, Dr. Lucian Howe, who was one of the most famous ophthalmologists in the 1920s and 30s, he became obsessed with eugenics and decided that what he was going to do is use the idea of hereditary blindness to convince people that we should carry out these forced sterilizations. And he, you know, used the argument that, well, it's a terrible thing to bring a blind child into the world and have to have all these problems. And so he wanted to look through society, find all the blind people, go through their families, see if there were any other people with blindness, and forcibly sterilize them. He even wrote up a bill for the New York legislature in which he was going to have forcible sterilization of all blind people in the United States and not allow them to get married. He'd make it illegal. Well, the bill didn't pass. Well, he didn't quit. He went back, and then he got the AMA involved, and the AMA formed a whole section of eugenics just for sterilizing blind people. Well, then he changed the designation and said, well, not only blindness, but any visual impairment should come under this provision. And Davenport and Laughlin, who were the big Rockefeller Foundation heads of this eugenics movement, they wanted to have the power through the courts to imprison anyone who was visually impaired so they could be placed in these labor camps. Now, they haven't created, you know, perpetrated any crime, but they could be forcibly put in a labor camp and prevent them from having babies. Well, Dr. Howe was asked by the court to define blindness, and he couldn't do it because he was trying to include anybody who had any visual difficulty at all. Well, he came up with another bill, which he submitted, and he called these unfit would have to post a cash bond to get married of $14,000 to $130,000. Now, this is back in the 1920s. And so he tried to get this bill through, and it's New York Bill 605 in 1922, and they tried to pass a bill making them post a bond of $14,000 to get married. Well, they voted it down, fortunately. And then he went to his third plan, a third bill he tried to submit, which would deport them from the state so that they would have to go back to the state from which they were born, and they could take all of their property, use it to pay the expenses of their deportation. And so the discussion was, well, you're going to impoverish these people. What are you going to do with them? And he said, well, if we get large enough numbers, we can put them in labor camps.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment. It's terrible to think of man's inhumanity to man, and yet it existed right here. Russell, go right ahead.
Well, you know, the gist of all of this is, and there's a lot of these stories in there that are even worse, where one of them was a man was off at work.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mined supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four tape or a four CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer Iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that'll protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Verky water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Verky water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
I know what it's like to lay awake at night and worry about mounting credit card debt. That nagging feeling in the pit of your stomach that just won't go away. And the phone calls from collectors. Forget about it. Then I called Help You Out of Debt. Their professional staff of debt mediators were able to help me get my upside-down finances back on track and help stop the phone call. My Help You Out of Debt settlement specialist understood exactly what I was going through. My specialist was able to get creditors off my back, negotiate huge reductions on most of my balances, and help me fight back against the credit card companies. Help You Out of Debt specialists are experts in debt mediation and settlement. They are on your side. They've helped thousands of people just like me and can help you too. Call now and get a free debt review. If you're $10,000 or more in credit card or unsecured debt and ready to start fighting back, call 866-374-3101 and get your free debt review. That's 866-374-3101 or on the web at helpyououtofdebt.com. 866-
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is Russell Blaylock, and Russell has just been talking about all of these macabre experiments, and so many of our intellectuals thought that really what was going on in Hitler's Germany was great. They were experimenting on people, and of course they wanted to eliminate the gypsies. They felt gypsies were inferior and Jews were inferior, and so... But there was tremendous support from the American intellectuals, about what was going on. Oh, isn't it wonderful now we can experiment on these people, things that could be done in Germany could never be done in America because of our laws. So you pick the story up there.
Yeah, and the most people know about the racial aspects of the German eugenicist program, but a lot of people don't understand. He also targeted everyone who was sick, particularly at chronic illnesses. So people with multiple sclerosis were also tagged to go to the concentration camps and be eliminated. People with any dementing illness, people with any chronic arthritis who were crippled and couldn't work. These people were all targeted for extermination.
Well, he really started out with the feeble-minded, the insane, and then graduated from there to the gypsies and then into the Jews, and then to the Christians. People don't understand that there were millions of Christians. There were 12 million others who were killed in the concentration camps beside the Jews, the majority of whom were Christians, and we never mention that in America today, and I wonder why not, but go right ahead.
Well, that's exactly right, and you know, that's the historical fact. That millions and millions, tens of millions of Christians were also killed. Many of these, their only crime was being ill. And in the schools in Germany, what they did to make people accept this, in the grammar schools, in the lower schools, they used math problems entailing extermination. For instance, they would say, a housing unit costs X number of marks. How many housing units could you buy for the young people of our country if we didn't spend 10 million marks per year on treating multiple sclerosis and incurable disease? That would be their math problem. So they grew up attuned to the fact that these people were a burden to society, they were useless, they had no function, and therefore the young people would be better off if they would help the government get rid of these people. Well, we think, you know, that's terrible. Only Hitler could think that, and that's why they portray Hitler as a psychotic. But he's no more psychotic than these people you read about at Harvard and Caltech and University of Chicago. They made very similar statements. In fact, Hitler quoted a lot of these people. He quoted Davenport, who was the chief eugenicist in America, leader in America, funded by the Rockefeller Foundation. So, you know, we had our own Hitlers in major institutions and positions of power. Well, we think if we read this history that is so clear and so well documented of this eugenic obsession in America, and you think, well, you don't think that can rise again? You're wrong. All they have to do is couch it in the proper terms. Well, there's a book written by Lily Kay, who is a professor of scientific history at MIT, and she wrote a book called The Molecular Vision of Life, which is the history of molecular biology. I got the book because I'm very interested in molecular biology, and I wanted to read about its history. I like to know how we the things we did. Well, the interesting thing about the book is it goes into a lot of detail of where molecular biology, where the idea for it came from. Well, it came from the Rockefeller Foundation, she said. She said they poured millions of dollars into creating these academic institutions to study the human gene and the human genetics. In fact, genetics was created out of this eugenic study. So they coined this term genetics by their own scientists, and it was a more accurate but a slower method of attaining social control, which was always the obsession of John D. Rockefeller Jr. and his son. And so throughout the literature and throughout this book, she tells that in everything that was written in academia about molecular biology, they used the word social engineering, social control, socialization, with the intent of it being how to control the human being and his behavior in society, that they felt an elitist had the responsibility of controlling all the members of society by this scientific endeavor.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest, of course, is Dr. Russ Blaylock, and we're talking about these macabre ideas that began at the beginning of the last century, but today they're practicing these same basic ideas. How do we control the masses? How do we control their thought process? You talk to the average person about what's really going on today, and most of them really don't want to hear. Most people are almost as if they're incapable of facing what is really going on in the world today. They'd much rather certainly be concerned about football or basketball or the Super Bowl, something of that sort. But as far as really being concerned about the terrible suffering going on throughout the world, much of it which is being brought on by our own policies, what's going on in Zimbabwe today is the end result of an experiment carried out by our State Department of putting a Marxist in power over there who's destroyed that country. And of course, we can see these things happening all throughout the world, but we don't like to think about it. And what they've done, I really believe, is by social engineering be able to control the reality of the average American. But you pick up the story there, Russell.
Well, that's exactly right. What you've outlined there is their goal. And this is what Bertrand Russell was even quoted as saying. You know, the famous American philosopher who wrote the book Why I'm Not a Christian, in a 1952 lecture, he essentially paraphrased him, said, students, as they go through school, must lose their free will, and that by the time they finish their schooling years, they should be incapable of resisting the leaders of the country. So he was expressing what the eugenicists and what the Rockefeller Foundation and its founders was expressing throughout this period, and that basically was that we need to learn how to control society, to engineer it so that people think and believe and behave the way we think they should, and take away their individual will. And throughout all of these works that you read, they see as the greatest danger individualism. Well, I noticed during the presidential election on the more leftist networks, they constantly referred to how individualism was the cause of the financial collapse, and that proved we needed to stop individualism and have government regulate and control things. We have to have people who are in elite positions who can control it. And, of course, this idea of getting rid of the
Hold that thought for just a moment. We'll be right back with it. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Russell Blaylock. And, of course, Russell is just pointing out how they've been using this phrase, you know, the individualism is the enemy. Individualism is the reason we're having all the problems. If we just should do away with individualism and have the government control everything, we would not have the problems we do today. Well, before we go on, Russell, would you like to get your website out and tell our listeners how they can get your newsletter? Russell puts out a newsletter every month through Newsmax, and it's really the finest medical newsletter there. We actually subscribe to it. Look forward to coming every month and read it. A phenomenal amount of information you need to know. And what about your website, and how can people get your newsletter?
Yeah, you can go to my website, www.russellblaylockmd.com, and it'll have at the top all the different categories. So you look under newsletter, and you can link directly to getting the newsletter. Also, I have a lot of free information on there, papers I've published on various subjects that are free for downloading, and you can look through that. Dr. Monteith carries my nutrition and behavior tape, which describes how nutrition affects behavior. And I bring that up because it's interesting. Another component of Bertrand Russell's statement was that they would use three things to control the youth of America and their thinking. And it'd be diet, injections, and injunctions. You know, so diet, we know from our neuroscience studies, plays a major role in human behavior. You know, the fluoridation of the water can make you apathetic. It can sterilize you. It depopulates the United States because it creates a fertility problem. That's been well demonstrated in scientific literature. Monosodium glutamate, the food additive, also can significantly interfere with fertility because of glutamate receptors in the reproductive tract, male and female. So these two in combination can produce significant problems with fertility. The government or the pharmaceutical companies in league with government, the AID, has been caught in Africa and Latin America putting a fertility antibody in the tetanus vaccine. And what clued them to the fact that they were doing this is they were giving the vaccine mostly to women. And the medical authorities said, why are you giving it to women? Men are the greatest risk of tetanus. And so they analyzed the vaccine and found an antitrophoblastic antibody and realized that they were using it as a birth control device. So they were pretending to do this humanitarian thing of preventing disease in Africa and Latin America when, in fact, what they were doing was reducing the population, making these women infertile. Well, we also have evidence that GMO foods, the genetically modified foods, can induce sterility in animals. And I've seen several people who were in animal husbandry that testified saying that when they fed their animals genetically modified corn, they could no longer breed. And when they switched them to the natural corn, they began breeding again. And when they put them back on the GMO, they once again became infertile. So we know this, and they're really pushing GMO foods very hard. You know, most of Africa will not allow GMO foods be imported. Only South Africa has been forced to do it. But they've been trying really hard. Well, there's an article in the Council on Foreign Relations, a major publication, Foreign Affairs, just on this subject, how the public needs to realize that all this scare about Franken foods and the fear of genetic modified foods is just not true, that it's safe and it's the greatest advance in food technology and it'll save millions of lives. Because they're obsessed with getting these target populations to be eating mostly GMO foods, which will make them infertile.
And, you know, I think it's so interesting that basically what they're doing is they up off the coast of Norway on a little island, they're storing all the seeds, but they know that they are going to destroy all of our foods here in the relatively near future through cross-pollinization. And certainly they've done this as far as canola oil, as far as corn, as far as cottonseed oil, things of that sort. And by they're actually contaminating all of our seeds. And so this, though it certainly there's no reason to expect that if the animals become infertile, that the human beings won't become infertile. And, you know, why do you think so many people, men, have a sexual dysfunction today? Why is it so many women can't get pregnant? Nobody ever wants to ask that. And what do the people know who are actually storing these seeds up there off the coast of Norway for some future time after the current generation has been destroyed? Could this possibly be what they have in mind? Certainly we are vaccinating all the children in Africa. And the Gates Foundation, the Bill Gates, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is doing that, but they're in favor of population control. Why would you possibly want to be immunizing the children and saving their lives if you're in favor of population control? And of course, that gets into the mercury and the vaccines, because we took it out of our vaccines here, but we left it in for those little children in Africa who we love so well, because that mercury will poison their reproduction. Go ahead.
Well, that's exactly right. And there's a book that I read on population control. It's a very detailed project that was carried out, very sophisticated. And they go through all the laws and regulations by the United Nations, the AID, and all of them, what they do is they go into these countries, and first they try to encourage people to control their population. But the Africans were very resistant. They said, no, we don't want anything to do with population control. And so they decided, well, probably the best thing we could do is go make it a stipulation, say, if you want to have electrification of your country and improve roads and all these other things done and loans for your government, you'll have to accept population control. Well, they don't tell the people that. They tell the government leaders that. Well, the leaders are in difficulty financially because they've accepted so many loans from the World Bank that they can't pay back. They're forced to accept this contract. And so then it looks like the government itself of the country is implementing the population control so it meets less resistance. And they go through law after law and case after case in every country in Africa and Latin America showing this is exactly what they do. To get back to the doomsday seed bank that Stan was talking about, the interesting, that's Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation also, and Rockefeller Foundation funded, and Monsanto, and the major manufacturers of GMO foods and the terminal seeds. What a terminal seed is, that it you can grow the crop that one season, but it will not produce any seeds the next season. You have to go back to Monsanto and buy all new seeds. Well, they are spreading that over the world, and the genes that are implanted in these GMO foods not only are getting in the other plants by cross-pollination, but they're finding it in the meat of animals. And what that means, according to court cases, is that then Monsanto will own all the animals in the world, the cattle, the sheep. All of these animals will belong to Monsanto if their gene ends up in it. And this has been tried in court cases in Canada, in which Monsanto won. If their seeds blow into an adjacent field of organically grown crops and contaminates them, then that farmer has to pay Monsanto for his crop because the genes are now incorporated in his plant. So what they're doing is creating, in my mind, this GMO crop that will spread over the whole world while they hide 3 million varieties of seeds in this seed bank. And it's highly guarded. I mean, it's got walls, 4 or 5 feet of reinforced concrete, guarded by troops. And it is the largest seed bank in the world. Well, there's 1,500 other seed banks in the world. They've gone through the world and purchased them as well. So what they'll have is ownership of all the seeds that can reproduce themselves that are not GMO, and then if the world will be at their control because, as it's been said many times, who controls the food controls the politics. People have to eat. They can't do without food. So if suddenly they find out the food is killing them and producing mass cancers or whatever, they say, well, we have the only seeds that aren't contaminated. And, you know, you will do what we say or you won't eat. You know, so it's a very powerful weapon in their hands. And people should be terrified by this. Even if you don't believe in any conspiracy theory, just the fact that this exists should terrify you that a commercial company in league with government organizations and foundations owns virtually the only, what will be the only surviving natural seeds in the world. And they put them in storage banks. So, you know, we're seeing things come together as you trace the history from what I told you about in the 1800s and early 1900s to now. We see that the sophistication of the molecular biology to control human life, control DNA, control behavior, control foods, and do it through vaccinations and DNA alterations is pretty frightening. And they even talk about things like producing genetically enhanced humans. And one researcher predicted that in another 50 years, human society be divided into the genetically enhanced humans and then the natural humans, which will be their workers. In other words, they'll be their slaves because they won't have this highly enhanced genetic structure that makes them superior intelligence, superior health, and live 200 years of age. You know, and this is all being proposed. There's whole books written on human engineering and, you know, scientific direction of Darwinism, all of these things are being written by serious scientists and being proposed. So we're right back where we were in the eugenics period, where there's a lot of interest in this in high academic and elitist centers, but now it's a lot more sophisticated. It's sort of like spying on people. Well, you couldn't do it very well back in 1901, but now with our technology, you can spy on everybody all the time, know what everybody is doing. Well, their dream, and they even write about this, Joseph Delgado wrote about it, that the last bastion of individualism is the human mind itself. And if they can rob you of that, then you will have no independence. There will be no independently thinking people any longer. And that's exactly what Francis Crick and Bertrand Russell talked about in the 1950s, that they wanted it where people no longer had independent thought. They just did and thought what the elitists wanted them to do and think. And unfortunately, because of our scientific advancement, we're entering that age. As I tell people, I spend most of my day reading neuroscience and the new things that are known about the human brain and how to control it. And I tell you, they're getting very, very sophisticated in ways to control human behavior and do it at a distance. You know, Dr. Delgado, was one of the world's foremost authorities on depth electrode stimulation of the human brain. He used to participate in all the major conferences on it. I've read his books in my scientific studies before he disappeared. And the reason he disappeared is he received massive funding from the government and foundations to go into hiding, and he no longer publishes papers. All of it's done in secret, and he has a massive lab, which the writer from Discover magazine was allowed to see briefly, and he told the guy, he said, I no longer have to put electrodes in your brain to make you have certain behavior. I can do it at a distance. I have microwave waves to tune in the neurons in particular areas of the brain and make you hear voices or see hallucinations or have thoughts, you know, that you don't want, that is beyond your will. And so we're very rapidly reaching that period of scientific and technological sophistication where we're really in danger of losing our free will, our independence.
And, of course, what people don't know is that they really are collecting dossiers on everybody. If you doubt that, there's a wonderful book written by the Major General William Odom. He was formerly the head of NSA, the top secret spy agency. And he wrote a book in 2003 called Fixing Intelligence. And, of course, he couldn't really tell us what's going on because he's sworn all sorts of secrecy oaths. But he could ask the questions like, should the CIA be assassinating people? Should the CIA have people, planted in the media and as journalists? And should the military be collecting dossiers on American citizens? Should the military be collecting dossiers on American citizens? When you go to your doctors or your dentist now, they ask you to sign a privacy agreement because, after all, they're so concerned about your privacy and they don't want that information released to anybody, and so without your permission. Have you ever read the form? And basically what it says is, now, we can release this to any government agency that says that they have the right to have it. What you're doing is giving up your privacy when you sign that. But you don't know that. You trust your doctor. You trust your dentist. They wouldn't deprive you of your privacy. They're required to by federal law. Understand, under the guise of law, why they're collecting dossiers with the most intimate details of your history of your life. That can always be used against you. Go right ahead, Russell.
Well, and they're also obsessed with collecting DNA data banks. There's been several books and articles written on that by people in the expert in the field of DNA physiology and, biometrics. And that's, not only eye scans and facial scans, but it's also DNA fingerprinting. And they're proposing that you can't, in the future, enter an airport until you have DNA fingerprinting. You'll have to be in the data bank. Customs stations, banks, schools, university program, whatever, you'll have to have your DNA fingerprints available in the file or you'll be arrested. We have things, for instance, like the Medical Information Bureau, which collects massive amounts of information. Like Dr. Montes said, when you go to your doctor, it's collected by the insurance data bank of 16 million Americans, constantly being updated. So they hope to expand it to include everybody.
In fact, one of the things in the recent bill they just passed this last week, supposedly to get our economy back, was a massive grant to begin, get all the medical records put onto electronics so they can be fed into a central database so they will know everything about you. You will have no privacy at all. What does that have to do with getting our economy going? Absolutely nothing. Our guest has been Dr. Russell Blaylock, and we'll be back in just a moment to wrap up tonight's program. Well, Russell, you got 3 minutes to wrap up the program for us. More than an hour sure went fast.
Give you an idea how far this has gone. Giuliani suggested that everybody be
I know what it's like to lay awake at night and worry about mounting credit card debt. That nagging feeling in the pit of your stomach that just won't go away, and the phone calls from collectors. Forget about it. Then I called Help You Out of Debt. Their professional staff of debt mediators were able to help me get my upside-down finances back on track and help stop the phone call. My Help You Out of Debt settlement specialist understood exactly what I was going through. My specialist was able to get creditors off my back, negotiate huge reductions on most of my balances, and help me fight back against the credit card companies. Help You Out of Debt specialists are experts in debt mediation and settlement. They are on your side. They've helped thousands of people just like me and can help you too. Call now and get a free debt review. If you're $10,000 or more in credit card or unsecured debt and ready to start fighting back, call 866-374-3101 and get your free debt review. That's 866-374-3101 or on the web at helpyououtofdebt.com. 866-374-3101.
With food prices soaring to all-time highs, as the dollar continues to fall in value, what can you and your family do to guarantee that fresh, nutritious vegetables will make it to your dinner table? Garden in a Can. Garden in a Can is your source for premium, long-term storable seeds. Garden in a Can is ready when you are. Plant them now or store them for when you really need them. There are 16 large, hermetically sealed, non-hybrid, open-pollinated packets of seeds, along with detailed planting instructions sealed in a can for ultimate long-term protection. Garden in a Can. It's that simple. Fresh, healthy, easy. Only $69.95 for over a half acre of safe, fresh vegetables. Ready when you are. Stop procrastinating and start preparing with Garden in a Can. For more details, visit GardenInACan.com today. That's GardenInACan.com or call 866-598-7396, 866-598-7396.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
Listen to a four-tape set, or it'll probably be a tape of the month for the month of January. Under any circumstances, why, we hope that you'll want to get more information on what we're talking about. We certainly have a four-tape set on population control. We have my talk on planned population reduction, another talk on population control, and another talk called Nundare College Genocide. That's Nundare College Genocide, Population Control and Planned Population Reduction. And there is a massive program out there to destroy humanity. And you say, why would rational people want to do that? Rational people wouldn't want to do that. And you're absolutely right. Rational people would not. But we're not dealing with rational people. We're dealing with people with a different worldview. To know how they're poisoning the children in Africa with the vaccines, let me suggest the DVD, when you get it, you get a CD-ROM with thousands of pages of scientific research on mercury, but it is a talk given by Dr. Ayoub. It's called Mercury Autism and the Global Population Agenda, going into how certainly the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which is so dedicated to population control, is putting up all this money to give those little children in Africa under the name of childhood vaccinations, substantial doses of mercury to destroy the reproductive system. And they know what they're doing. All the scientific data is there. So, again, it's the mercury autism and the global population control agenda, and we throw in a CD-ROM with thousands of pages of scientific studies. They know what they're doing. They just don't want you to know what they're doing. And then, of course, we do hope you'll want to get my book on the Brotherhood of Darkness, my talk on the forbidden secret and the syllabus that goes with that, my talk on the planned police state and the syllabus that goes with that, our material on concentration camps, either the DVD or the four-tape set, or get the concentration camp special. And then, of course, we've got a wonderful new DVD we've talked about in the past. The Eye of the Phoenix. The Eye of the Phoenix, and of course it's put out by our good friend Chris Pinto, and it deals with the symbology on the back of the dollar bill, where they hide their satanic emblems in plain sight, and you look at them every day, and you can't believe that they would be that flagrant, but they are, and of course all of these ideas came out of the Luciferian movement in the mid-1930s, where Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the man who packed the Supreme Court with Masons who would take God and prayer out of high schools, when Franklin Delano Roosevelt and his good friend Henry Wallace, the Secretary of Agriculture, who was deeply involved in theosophy and Satanism, and of course he was also a high-degree Mason, a follower of Nicholas Roark, who was one of the leading Satanists of that time, and certainly the mentor of Manly P. Hall, who was the leading Satanist of the mid-part of the last century, right up till 1990 when he died. But basically, they got together and they put the satanic emblem on the back of the dollar bill, the Novus Ordo Seclorum, the new secular order. And, of course, that's what we're talking about today. Is it simply by accident that when Barack Obama gave his inauguration speech, and I hope you'll get it and read it, and notice how, not once, but on two occasions, he talked about the new age, on another one, the new era, and then the new man. All, of course, the Novo Ordo Seclorum, the new secular order that is coming. As we turn our back on Christianity, where the state will control everything, and, of course, to incorporate accomplices, they're going to have to destroy our economy, to destroy the value of our currency, impoverish our people. You'll certainly want to read my newsletters, my November and December newsletters. They're up on the Internet at RadioLiberty.com. RadioLiberty.com. And of course, many of you, remember our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America is under attack today. Please pray for America. Pray for revival, because without revival, this land will be lost. But pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Mr. William Grieg, of course, formerly senior editor of the New American Magazine, and now working full-time, running the blog for the Welch Foundation, that's writing, and, of course, appearing on radio programs, and we feel fortunate to have William with us. Once again, good evening, William. How are you feeling?
Good evening. I'm feeling all right. I appreciate that. I've still got a little bit of a dry cough from the vagaries of winter-related health, but other than that, I'm unscathed by the season.
All right, fine. Well, we're glad to have you back with us.
And, well, thank you.
And what are we going to talk about this evening?
We have to talk about some of the really nasty things that are happening as our full-blown descent into an economic depression and undisguised corporate socialism continues apace. As a matter of fact, it accelerates dramatically. We have this monstrosity of a so-called stimulus bill that is nothing more than a turbocharged subsidy and re-engineering, if you will, of the welfare state. It's designed to sluice all kinds of taxpayer money into the many, many troughs of the constituents that have battened onto the Democratic Party now for 60 or 70 years. Of course, the Acorn Group is going to be a major beneficiary. They were one of the major rocket boosters that propelled Obama to the presidency, and they're getting a payoff right now. But that's pretty typical what's going on. The so-called Keynesian stimulus, which is supposed to be a short-term measure to increase aggregate demand and keep prices up and keep people employed, is in fact nothing more, nothing less than a hyperthyroid version of the same old Democratic Party constituent fattening politics of lore.
But how is this going to create jobs for now, the average individual?
Yeah, you're not going to be creating a whole lot of jobs if you're throwing hundreds of millions of dollars into the National Endowment for the Arts and billions of dollars into, for instance, the effort to supposedly to prevent the spread of sexually transmitted diseases. Or one of the brilliant things that we heard from Nancy Pelosi was the idea that somehow if the government gets heavily into the business of promoting contraception and presumably abortion again, this is going to provide an economic stimulus by, I'm guessing, reducing the number of people that the economy has to service. Now, there's a really interesting premise implicit in that idea, namely that when the government is in the business of the economy, then the population is simply another variable to be manipulated by the government, and all these inputs are equal, and so in order to bring the population into some kind of harmony with the available productivity, you reduce the number of people because, of course, every time the government intervenes in the economy, it creates shortages and makes it more difficult to satisfy the needs of the population. That's the old communist politics of scarcity taken to its logical conclusion. You know, people being another resource to be managed by the state, the human population simply another economic indicator to be manipulated in the interests of the entire economic system, you end up with radical population control and depopulation. It was pioneered by the Jacobins back in the 1790s. It was perfected by the Soviets and the Nazis. The Romanian communists and Chinese communists, of course, practiced both ends of that type of population control, both limiting the population through compelled abortion and infanticide, and then, when necessary, reversing those policies so as to make birth compulsory, so as to have a larger population.
But now, how is this going to keep people in their homes? And after all, I think that certainly Henry Paulson said that the major problem is this collapse in the housing prices, certainly all the foreclosures. I mean, we have to stop this cycle. So how is all this spending going to keep anybody in their homes at all?
Yeah,
and of course, it's not designed to address the problem. It is designed to give the impression that they're addressing the problem, while it grows worse and worse.
Well, to ask questions of that sort, of course, is to suggest the answer, and the answer is that none of this has anything at all to do with the rescue of the middle class, the rescue of the imperiled homeowners. the mitigation of the problem of resetting mortgages, people losing their homes, and mortgages going into default, thereby creating a chain reaction that wipes out financial institutions. Another half dozen, if I'm not mistaken, it was either three, four, or half dozen banks failed today. That sort of thing is not getting a whole lot of press right now, because it's just a steady little drip, drip, drip at the periphery while we have this huge roaring tidal wave of bad news. But, of course, what we're finding out is that this whole thing is entirely pretextual. The people who are running this program, running this agenda, know how to palliate the sensibilities of people, or at least distract them long enough to get what they're really after. And what they're really after, of course, is the consolidation of power on behalf of those who are in the power elite. I mean, the Tim Geithner case is a perfect example. I mean, you've got somebody here in his late 40s. He's not much older than I am. I think he's the same age as Mr. Obama. He's somebody who, for his entire adult life, has been an errand boy and an understudy for the power elite. Until the last 10 or 15 years, he was sort of an understudy. If anybody is familiar with the lore of Star Wars, it's like he was an understudy to a Sith Lord, or so to a succession of Sith Lords. First, he was working for Henry Kissinger, Kissinger Associates, which is one of the most evil and despicable little outposts of the power elite, because it seems as if all they ever do is find ways to broker deals that end up precipitating wars and other conflicts, and they end up cleaning up on both sides of it. It's an old ploy. It's one of the oldest tactics, gambits, the playbook of Machiavelli's and equally disreputable people throughout history. But Mr. Kissinger, of course, is a past master of the same, and he organized a little shop in the 1980s, and Mr. Geithner was one of the young associates back in the late 80s when the Kissinger Associates group was arranging the Iraq War by helping to bring about the subsidized arms buildup of Saddam's arsenal on the one hand, and on the other hand, representing Kuwaiti interests. So they were playing both sides very profitably. But from there, Mr. Geithner ended up going into the Treasury Department, studying under the likes of Larry Summers and Robert Rubin. Those are people who are very adept at redirecting taxpayer wealth to benefit banking interests on Wall Street. And he spent some time, after serving in the Treasury Department in the Clinton administration under several Secretaries of the Treasury, graduating to a job with the International Monetary Fund, which along with the World Bank is basically running the biggest scam in history in a financial sense, in that what they do is they're practicing extortion under the cover of humanitarian aid. That's something that...
Hold that thought. Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with William. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William was just talking about Timothy Geithner and his background and how this young man, he's about the age of Obama, President Obama, and Geithner has really, of course, what people don't mention, he's a member of the Trilateral Commission, mm-hmm. Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderbergers, the Group of 30. He is simply a disciple of Henry Kissinger. He's part of the power structure. He was president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York City. He's one of the primary architects of this whole debacle. And, Father, he has been working right along with Henry Paulson not to address the issue. I mean, they could have, when they got that $700 billion, they could have gone in and bought up all these defective bonds all throughout the world and solved the problem right there, but they don't want to solve the problem. If they solved the problem, how would they be able to impoverish the American people? How would they be able to destroy our economy? How would they be able to bring about the new world order that they're hoping as they destroy the economy, not only of America, but the entire world economy is collapsing, and they could have stopped it, and they chose not to because they have a different world vision. But you go right ahead with it.
Yeah, I mean, you take a look at his pedigree and the fact that he was deeply involved in just about every rung of this ladder of influence that leads him now to the point where he's the de facto economic dictator of the United States, working as part of a little tandem with Ben Bernanke at the Federal Reserve. The Secretary of the Treasury, whoever he is, has plenary authority to spend as much as he wants or to use the so-called full faith and credit of the United States government to assume the debts of any entity that he deems to be a worthwhile entity in the interests of bailing out the economy, bailing out the financial sector. And the fact that they have spent so much time and directed so many trillions of dollars and assumed so many trillions of dollars in obligations on behalf of the clubs that they belong to, and And we see now the big stimulus program is basically a big payoff to it's a cattle call payoff to a pork barrel project, classic pork barrel politics, payoff to the Democratic Party's core constituencies. We see that none of this has anything to do with mitigating the problems of the economy, much less ensuring that the people who are confronted with foreclosure, eviction, and the complete collapse of their financial situation would somehow receive some help. All this is about consolidating positions here. And the spending, as you point out, Dr. Stan, this amount of money, the creation of this volume of money, expending the money supply by this order of magnitude, is guaranteed to finish the job of destroying the economy. And these people will be left in the commanding heights of whatever remains in the political structure and in the economy. They will be very well cared for. They will be able to make whatever use of whatever resources they need in order to ensure the survival of their ruling elite, and the rest of us will be reduced to utter peonage. We'll be like the Helots in ancient Greece. And this is all taking place at a time now when people are being anesthetized by mass entertainment. As you like to point out, reality is something most people like to treat as optional. We must be the most reality-averse of culture in recorded human history. Part of that's because we are so besotted with ourselves and so easily distracted by the baubles of temporary celebrity and so fascinated by this artificial culture of celebrity. We are utterly beset with distractions, electronic distractions, cultural distractions of the sort that no previous generation has had to deal with. And so we seem to think that if we can cocoon ourselves in a little bubble of ersatz prosperity and glittering celebrity, that we can insulate ourselves from the consequences of these developments in the outside world. We have less excuse because information is more readily available to us than it has been to any other previous culture that has confronted the type of crisis that we're dealing with right now. When the Romans were dealing with the collapse of their empire and their economy in the 5th century and the late 4th century of the Christian era, most of the people didn't really fully understand what was going on. If you take a look at what happened even as recently as Weimar Germany, I really doubt that most Germans fully understood what was going on when they were dealing with the hyperinflation of the 20s and then the political and cultural collapse that brought the National Socialists to power. Right now, of course, it's not so much that information is controlled, it's just that information is filtered in such a way and manipulated in such a way that which is more appealing, more enticing or alluring to the masses is unreliable. You know, the truth is pretty readily available to somebody with a modest amount of curiosity and just a particle of industry, but it's so much easier, of course, to take your predigested opinions from television or from talk radio, from the approved media personalities, and to accept that as at face value. And as a result, people have been obsessing about the stylistic and cultural cues of Barack Obama and the new First Family, and worrying about the spectator sport aspects of partisan politics, while the plates beneath our feet, the tectonic plates upon which we stand, are literally shifting, and this huge cavernous gap is opening right beneath us, and we're finding ourselves caught in this undertow that's going to pull us down into outright, undisguised tyranny. And it's not going to take that long. I really don't know how much longer the economy is going to continue to sputter along until we actually hit this moment of a profound crisis where people will suddenly realize that we're dealing with something existential here. I mean, we've been talking in terms of terrorism now since 9/11 about so-called existential threats to the United States, as if a group of Bedouins hunching in a cave somewhere in the trackless wilds of Afghanistan could somehow threaten the existence of the United States without the help of our traitorous leadership, of course. But we are confronting an existential threat here to the middle class, that is to say, to a class that is financially secure, or at least financially capable of becoming financially secure, and upwardly mobile, materially able to improve our circumstances and to transmit a higher standard of living to our children and those who come after us. You know, people who do not owe fealty to a liege lord, that's what the middle class is all about. We're supposed to be independent, upwardly mobile, and somewhat materially secure. We are confronting an existential crisis. entirely possible that the middle class as we know it will be extinct within the next couple of years because of what's being done to the economy right now.
Well, I think even more than the economy, it's what's being done to the stability of our currency. Because right now what people don't understand is the Federal Reserve is beginning to print money to buy our treasury bills.
Yeah.
And we're developing this tremendous debt. And what do you do with it? Well, you have to finance it. How do you finance it? Other countries come in and buy up the debt, and that's how we're able to continue spending more than we produce. But now other countries are not buying our debt as much as they have.
Mm-hmm.
And for the first time in history, the Federal Reserve is talking about monetizing the debt. But that is highly inflationary. That's the sort of thing that they did in the Weimar Republic.
Yep.
That's the sort of the thing they're doing in Zimbabwe today. And where is the outcry? Why, people are saying, there's nothing to worry about. Why, we've got to maintain a little bit of inflation to maintain our prosperity. Ladies and gentlemen, there is no better way to destroy a nation than to debauch the currency. And this is the major threat to the middle class today. But go right ahead, William.
Yeah, I mean, what we're talking about is the government destroying the one thing that must not be a variable. If you're going to have a free market economy, you've got to have a currency that is rooted in a standard that is fixed and immovable. And, of course, throughout recorded human history, gold has been the most suitable way to anchor an economy. You have a standard set, very precious divisible commodity. It's portable, it's divisible, it has what is regarded as intrinsic value. It's the sort of a thing that cannot be easily duplicated. It can't be duplicated at all. I mean, only God can make real money, gold and silver being the most suitable examples of the same. And what's happened is that over the last many decades, almost a century since 1913, you know, it's been 96 years now, I guess, 94 years, since the Federal Reserve came into existence, our currency has lost 97% of its value. The currency that we have right now is basically worthless. And that's an achievement, as I've said before, a perverse achievement that is quite remarkable in as much as that it took Rome the better part of half of a millennium to do what the Federal Reserve accomplished in less than a century, which is to destroy almost entirely the value of the currency in question. And what is really interesting is that in order to save the currency, in order to back away from the monetization of the debt, in order to stop accumulating debt and try to reverse the trends that we're talking about, some real intrinsic systemic change would be necessary. We hear nothing about any kind of tangible interest on the part of those who rule us in the types of changes that would save the middle class by rolling back the huge and metastasizing debts that Washington has accumulated. One significant change would be to abandon our interventionist foreign policy, on which we spend, to Representative Ron Paul, roughly $1 trillion a year. They were to stop spending that money, which is money they don't have, and cut back that expenditure alone. That would have, if we would have done this, say, a year and a half or 2 years ago, that alone would have been enough to reverse the decline in our economy, if you had that amount of money no longer being spent, that amount of debt no longer being generated, and if we were to start deflating in a fashion commensurate with the rollback of government spending, that would actually conduce to prosperity in the very short term. You know, if we were to do that, and if we were to allow the economy to take its natural course by contracting, seeing as how we've been living well beyond our means, you have to live within your means. If you've been living beyond your means, you have to live below them in order to recover your equilibrium. If we're to allow the economy to contract and throw out all of the accumulated bad mistakes, malinvestments, disinvestments of the boom, it would take 3 or 4 years of fairly painful economic realignment. It's called a correction, and a correction is almost never a pleasant thing. But those two things alone might have rescued the middle class and restored our prosperity, and there was no interest in Washington in taking either of those measures under consideration.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here with William Green. Well, go right ahead, William.
Well, now we read in the Financial Times that on Monday, there's this expectation that the Obama administration will announce something called a Big Bang financial cleanup. Presumably this would have something to do with the idea of creating this new bad bank, as if that's not a functional redundancy. Every bank in a fractional reserve banking system with an inflatable currency is a bad bank. They're all bankrupt by nature. It's all a huge Ponzi scheme. But they're talking about some kind of a Big Bang financial cleanup that will reflect the beliefs of course, Tim Geithner, who's the Treasury Secretary, and Lawrence Summers, his former tutor, who's the director of the National Economic Council. So the whole idea is that they want to have some dramatic announcement here about a new role where the government will, I believe, eventually just nationalize outright the entire banking system. At least that's the logic of what they're talking about right now. And, of course, the Big Bang is the accepted secular science term for creation, the idea that the entire universe existed as an infinitely dense, infinitely small singularity of space, time, and matter, and that at some point it somehow caused itself to expand, and that expansion has been going on ever since. I think the metaphor is wrong. I don't think they're talking about a Big Bang. They might be talking about the reversal of the Big Bang, which according to contemporary post-relativistic astrophysics is the Big Crunch, where everything compacts itself back down into that one singularity. Actually, I think a better metaphor still would be supernova, a supernova that creates a black hole. A black hole, of course, being in contemporary theoretical science a tear in the rip of space-time that is the result of the of something achieving such density and mass that it literally rips a hole in the universe, and it creates a well so steep and a gravitational force so powerful that not even light can escape it. I mean, that's basically where we're headed. We're headed towards a black hole, a supernova followed by a collapse into a black hole, which, of course, is what happened in Weimar Germany and is what happened and what's happening right now in Zimbabwe. You've got in Zimbabwe, once again, what I am convinced is something of a controlled test case to see just how deeply you can drive a once prosperous country into outright barbarism through unchecked hyperinflation. I honestly think that the people who are running Zimbabwe behind the scenes, I mean, Mr. Mugabe, obviously, the demented, deranged, bloody-handed, subhuman dictator running that country, is the hands-on ruler, and his death squad, the so-called army veterans, most of whom, of course, were in the cradle when the Civil War was going on, the most recent Civil War in that country, they're actually the ones who administer the beatings and the killings that keep Mr. Mugabe in power. But the ones that are Mr. Mugabe's patrons and mentors and supporters, the ones who arranged his ascent to power in that country and the ones who have propped up his rule for these many decades, I honestly believe that right now they're running some kind of a controlled experiment to see just how far you can go in driving the process of hyperinflation, because there's no reason at all why that economy would function at all right now were it not being artificially sustained by the West. You pointed out many occasions how the so-called aid that we're providing, the purported humanitarian aid to Zimbabwe, is keeping that government entrenched and prolonging the agony of the Zimbabweans. And I really think that there is a sinister motive here. I think that they're using this as a control test.
Hold that thought. Okay, go right ahead. Doug Whittem is just talking about what's going on over in Zimbabwe. And he is suggesting that maybe this is just a social experiment. Remember, we brought Mugabe to power, the Marxist communist thug who is today the dictator there. We've kept him in power all of this time. We've continued giving him humanitarian aid, supposedly because of the terrible suffering of the people, those who haven't already fled. Half the population has already fled the country. But, of course, it's really used to keep the brutal military and brutal police in power to suppress the people. So why would we do something that stupid, you know, and they're all the time protesting, you know, what a terrible thing is happening over there and how concerned we are about the suffering. We brought this about. We promised that Rhodesian people would intervene. If things ever got out of hand, they got out of hand. And so what did we do? Why, we attacked Afghanistan. in the name of capturing Osama bin Laden, but he wasn't there, so we just kept on fighting and fighting. But we ignore Rhodesia that we gave our solemn word to protect. So William is suggesting maybe this is a social experiment. They just want to see how far you can destroy a great nation through inflation. And, of course, are they planning on doing that here? Certainly, we're already beginning to see the first seeds of this as they're talking about monetizing our massive debt. And pick up the story, William.
Yeah, when you monetize the debt, of course, what you're doing is you're repudiating it. What you're telling your creditors is that rather than providing you with something of relative worth, we're going to give you a supply of increasingly depreciating paper. We're going to give you bad dollars in exchange for the good dollars you lend us, or the relatively good dollars that you lent to us. What you do is that you essentially keep putting IOUs in the pot and expect them to be treated as real money. That's how monetization works, and that's how, for instance, as we pointed out, countries that have found themselves in impossibly deep debt historically have repudiated their debt through inflation. Well, of course, the first thing that happens if your creditors no longer are interested in receiving depreciating paper currency in exchange for what they have lent to you, then your currency becomes non-convertible. You can't use it outside your borders. That happened to Iceland. It's brought down the Icelandic government. That's something that may be happening very quickly to the British sterling. The pound sterling might be heading that direction very quickly. Jim Rogers, a week ago, was saying that he really expects that very quickly the pound sterling is going to go the way of the Icelandic krona. Think of that for a second. If the British pound sterling were to collapse, what that would mean in world historic terms, I mean, that was in the early decades of the 20th century, that was what the dollar is today. That was the not the same type of a relationship to the other world economies and currencies that the dollar has, but to the extent that there was a world reserve currency before the dollar, it was the pound sterling, and the pound sterling may be headed for extinction right now for the same reason the Icelandic krona is headed for extinction. You know, you've got bank failures, you've got the government nationalizing banks. When you nationalize a bank, you have to inflate the currency. When you inflate the currency to a certain extent, your foreign creditors no longer want to accept that in exchange for what they have lent you, and suddenly the currency becomes non-convertible. Of course, that means that within the borders of a nation, the currency becomes almost useless as a medium of exchange as well. And we've seen that happen to many governments. It could very easily happen to the United States. Gerald Celente, who's one of the better and more capable prognosticators of economic and cultural trends, thinks that's going to start happening this year. He may have a very good point. I don't see what's keeping it up apart from what's keeping the dollar up right now as a instrument of exchange anywhere, apart from the fact that there is still a lot of deleveraging going on. People need to become liquid and get out of some of the positions they're in right now. That creates a demand for dollars. And as soon as that's finished, you're going to see what's going on right now in the bond markets. This so-called bond market rally is going to end very quickly. It's going to end very badly. And when that happens, when the T-bills finally start to collapse here, and people stop buying them, there's no longer this rally to the dollar. The rally will quit, and very quickly you're going to have a flat plunge. I think the dollar will plunge like a Russian submarine, and that's something that will create havoc here in this country very quickly. I think that one of the reasons I've been emphasizing for a long, long time, the need for people to acquire pre-1964 silver currency is that that would provide them with some temporary stability if and when the dollar plunges that drastically. You need something that will be accepted rather than the funny paper that will no longer have any intrinsic value. I think that time may occur either this year or the next if people like Gerald Celente and Jim Rogers are right.
Well, I think we're entering a very, very difficult time. I think the average individual doesn't know. One of the most rewarding things, William, is how often people will call us at home and say, thank you, we listen to you, we're prepared, you know, we know what lies ahead. And I just hope that more of you, if you've not made preparations, begin. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is William Grigg, and we're talking about what's going on. We're talking really about the erosion of the value of our currency that many people who are very knowledgeable, like Jim Rogers, is talking about how the British pound sterling, could collapse and go the way of the Icelandic corona. And, of course, if that should happen, would the dollar be far behind? Well, of course, we can always print more dollars. We don't have to worry. There's nothing to worry about. But the trouble is, every time you print a dollar, why, you destroy a little bit of the value of all the other dollars out there. And pretty soon, why, you have all these dollars out there, and they have less and less value. And then foreigners stop buying our bonds because they don't want to get, you know, invest in a currency, in the bonds of a nation where the currency is declining in value, and then suddenly they begin dumping all their dollars. They bring them over here and they start buying things up frantically because they want to get something of value for a currency that is rapidly declining in value. And then suddenly we're flooded with trillions of dollars because the foreigners hold probably between $3 and $4 trillion of our currency. And then what happens? Well, go right ahead, William.
Yeah, and of course, when you're talking about bank bailouts in the range of $3 to $4 trillion since last September, you know, that means basically that the people who have invested the, you know, $3 to $4 trillion of the economy are seeing the value of their investments go down. And they can anticipate how this is going to work out. I mean, good grief, the head of China's central bank is part of the Group of 30. He's somebody who consults with Tim Geithner and the others, the grand panjandrums of the fiat money economy, the global dollar fiat money economy. So they know what's going on. They work in tandem. They work in coordination. And, of course, China's central bank, like the Japanese central bank and like government-owned banks and the petroleum exporting countries, Saudi Arabia in particular, they are all very much aware of what's going on with the inflation of the dollar here in order to bail out the American and other Western financial entities. Let's not forget, we should point out that the Fed's not merely bailing out American banks, it's bailing out European banks. It's working in tandem with the European the central banks of the various constituent nations of the European Union to bail out other banks that are co-parties with American financial institutions. And it's doing so without any accountability. There's no oversight by Congress. Congress has no, basically what Congress can do is complain. They cannot alter any of the decisions that are being made. They cannot require that any accounting be made. The Freedom of Information Act request has been filed by Bloomberg News, and I believe by a couple of other news organizations.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly William is making the very valid point that, you know, our Congress, our elected representatives are really irrelevant. The power elite that runs our country just goes on their own way. We can't even find out what happened to $2 trillion that Ben Bernanke has given away. Bloomberg can't find out. Congress can't find out. $2 trillion, where did it come from? Where did it go? Oh, we can't let that information out. That would endanger the safety of our country. That's a state secret. That is a, you know, that is classified information. We can't release classified information to you people there in Congress, as if you really think that you are relevant at all. And what people really need to know is we have two governments. We have an elected government. We have an invisible government. And the invisible government really runs things. The visible government postures and gives speeches and addresses, but they really are totally irrelevant as far as anything going on in the world today. So pick up the story there, William. Before we go on, though, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get your material.
The easiest way to find my material is to go to willgrigg.com. And from there, if you look in the upper right-hand corner of the first page of that website, you can go to my blog, Pro Libertate. It's very easy. You go to the upper right-hand corner of willgrigg.com. There's a list of external links. The very first one will take you to Pro Libertate, which is the blog that I maintain. I usually update it between 3 and 5 times a week. The typical piece that I post is between 1,200 and 2,000 words, but lately I've been trying to write a little bit, I've been trying to write pieces that are a little bit briefer than that in the interest of making them more reader-friendly, and also because my time is at a premium right now on account of the fact that next week my wife was going to have another baby. We've been trying to get ready for that arrival, and we're planning on naming our next son, who will be our sixth child. Our next son will be named Justice Samuel. I invited readers of Pro Libertate to submit suggestions for names for our new child, and many, many readers very generously and thoughtfully provided all kinds of wonderful patriotic and biblical suggestions. I'm very deeply indebted to my readers for doing so. I know that many of them listen to this program. We decided on J-U-S-T-U-S, Justice Samuel. Justice is a name from the Bible. James the Just, who's referred to as the brother of the Lord Jesus, was known as James Justice. And we are expecting that arrival on next Tuesday. But so for that reason, my time's been at a premium this week. I've only written two essays. They're both under 1,000 words. That's somewhat unusual. Pro Libertate is a blog that is a little bit different from most blogs in the online community in that it does have longer pieces of that sort. They tend to be more fully fleshed out works of what I call investigative polemics. I'm an opinion writer. I don't disguise my point of view. I'm utterly obsessed with individual freedom and dignity. I am a Christian in my outlook. That dictates to me my libertarian politics. Libertarianism teaches that the highest political good is individual liberty, and that from individual liberty will flower genuine human progress in the form of peaceful cooperation through commerce, through mutual associations of interest, and that if you minimize the amount of coercion by forbidding the aggressive use of violence, and by enhancing the quality of life through allowing people to develop their talents, that the world will be a much, much better place than it is right now. There are many wonderful things about the world even now as it's presently constituted, but we all admit that the world could be much better, especially now that we're looking down the barrel of a depression along with two wars overseas and the prospect of many other wars to follow. I honestly believe that if we were to make a priority of returning to the values taught by the Lord in the Sermon on the Mount, and in the Ten Commandments, the two great commandments, of course, love God with all your heart and love your neighbor as yourself, we're to obey those commandments, I believe that we would be practicing what in political terms would be called libertarianism or individualism. And that's the perspective that's reflected on my blog. I spend a lot of time talking about the police state that is taking tangible shape around us. And that's the subject of my most recent book, Liberty in Eclipse, The War on Terror, and the Rise of the Homeland Security State. It's available through Amazon.com. You can click through at the bottom of my blog essays on a hyperlink that's right next to a picture of the cover of that book if you want to order it. Since it's going to be available at half.com as well, we're trying to work out the arrangements for that. I know that you and my other friends at Radio Liberty have sold a great deal of that book as well. We're going to get you another quantity of them as soon as I can get them from the distributor. I promise I'll get you some. I'll get you a couple of cases of that book. But once again, the purpose of writing that book was to let people understand, by putting in context recent developments, the development of the Homeland Security State, where rather than having a law enforcement system that is locally accountable and that is a civilian force of peace officers, what we have now basically is an army of occupation, the purpose of which is to control the population on behalf of our rulers. That's what a Homeland Security State is all about. We're about to see a really interesting display of the Homeland Security State this weekend, in that the Transportation Security Administration, which is one of my least favorite branches of government, has announced that it's going to be providing some of the security for the Super Bowl. Now, that's obviously a mission that's well a field of its area of responsibility, and given the fact that the TSA has done nothing but fail spectacularly at the advertised purpose for its existence, which is to provide security on airline flights, that's something which really is a case of a solution seeking a problem, I think. While the TSA has also become notorious for the kleptomaniacs in their midst. TSA baggage handlers have stolen all kinds of things to the tune of many millions of dollars since the creation of that agency. And now, of course, they're being given this high-profile gig at the Super Bowl as a way of enhancing their brand name. But the TSA is just one of the tendrils of this hydra-headed monstrosity that is the Homeland Security State. And so if you're interested, if anybody in the listening audience is interested in reading more about that, I heartily recommend that they read the book Liberty and Eclipse, because it does provide a survey of the trends that led to this point and some suggestions as to what we could do about paring back the Homeland Security State and trying to restore some semblance of actual individual rights-based legal order in this country. And Dr. Stanton, on the subject of Homeland Security, I don't doubt for a second that you have discussed with your audience this exceptionally troubling new bill, H.R. 645, and what that portends for our country, the National Emergency Centers Establishment Act. I would be willing to bet that this week you probably spent a lot of time talking about that. But that's an outgrowth, of course, of a trend that you and I talked about regarding this contract that was given to Halliburton to create these detention facilities for special functions, supposedly, of course, for the detention of illegal aliens within the United States, but not expressly or solely for that purpose. And Halliburton, back in the 1990s, as I point out, this is something I point out in the book, in the 1990s they received a contract, another no-bid contract, this is under the Clinton administration, to build a similar facility on the island of Cuba at Guantanamo Bay, purportedly to house Haitian immigrants, refugees who would be fleeing from Haiti during the upheavals that occurred, attended to the conflict over the return of Aristide back in the early 1990s. Halliburton got a contract to build this facility to house Haitian refugees. That facility now, of course, is notorious for being the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay, Camp X-Ray and the environs. They were built by Halliburton for one purpose, and now they're being used for a rather different purpose. They're being used to house people who have no rights of any kind the government has to respect, according to the federal government, and for interrogation that includes many forms of psychological torment and outright physical torture. Well, this H.R. 645, the National Emergency Centers Establishment Act, for the creation of national emergency centers, at least six of them, has a couple of provisions in it that I think are worth talking about in terms of what this portends for the future. You can really see the malign intentions that our rulers have toward us. If you take a look at the provisions of this bill, and according to the purposes of this act, the first purpose is to provide temporary housing, medical, and humanitarian assistance. The phrase pops up in the unlikeliest places. Provide temporary housing, medical, and humanitarian assistance to individuals and families dislocated due to an emergency or major disaster. That's something, of course, that could include a financial collapse, widespread unemployment, huge social upheavals having to do with sudden and thoroughly disorienting loss of work by many millions of people. You had urban riots or food riots that were to erupt somewhere in this country, no doubt this is the sort of thing that would be declared a national emergency, and you would have at least six of these facilities that would be used to provide temporary housing for these economic refugees, I believe. But that's all pretextual. The point is, you'd be creating these facilities on military campuses across the country, at least six of them, in military bases, that would be used to hold, you know, whether you want to hold, call it holding or housing, I don't care which verb you use. I believe that the upshot is that they would be held on a military facility. You wouldn't necessarily be housed there. The second of the purposes of the
bill. Now, who are you suggesting that would be held there?
I'm sorry?
Who are you suggesting would be held?
Well, I think that the pretext would be that they need some kind of facility for people who are caught in some kind of a severe crisis, be it a natural disaster or an economic collapse. Because we'd all be told that the lessons of Katrina shouldn't be lost on us. We can't simply let these people sit out in rotting, toxic, FEMA-supplied trailers, so it's a good thing that we have these facilities. But that would merely be a pretext. The fact is, I think that they would start rounding up troublemakers who are causing the problems, supposedly, and hold them there in military custody, rather than taking in the humanitarian refugees. I believe that they would identify people of special interest and put them in the military facilities and then extol their own wisdom and foresight in providing these facilities in the event that we had some kind of a problem. They say, well, this is what they were meant to be used for, but it's just an immensely good, an immensely useful piece of good fortune that we happen to have them. That's how I think they'd handle it. But it's the second of the purposes of this measure that I find really provocative here in Section B, number two, the purpose of this National Emergency Center shall be to use existing infrastructure to provide centralized locations for the purposes of training and ensuring the coordination of federal, state, and local first responders, and then to provide centralized locations to improve the coordination of preparedness, response, and recovery efforts of government, private, and not-for-profit entities and faith-based organizations, and to meet other appropriate needs as determined by the Secretary of Homeland Security. That, of course, means that whatever happens to cause a brief tremor within the synapses of the Commissar for Homeland Security would be considered a suitable purpose for these facilities. But later on in the bill, it talks about how, irrespective of what goes on with respect to these emergencies, whether there are or aren't matters of concern and national security importance taking place, the training and coordination functions will be permanent. What that means is that they're talking about militarizing all these elements of the Homeland Security system, the first responders, the government, private, not-for-profit entities, faith-based organizations. They're all going to be coordinated with the military. That's a very important part of the whole logic of the Homeland Security state, which is that everything has to be brought into tandem and regimented with the military, that everything has to be put on the basis of basically a militarized garrison state model, as opposed to having a civilian-run and civilian-equipped and civilian-oriented system. Everything now is being operated as if we're talking about Prussianizing the entire system. And this, once again, would be permanent. We may not have hurricanes or floods or tidal waves or earthquakes. We may not have a huge stock market collapse. The bottom may not follow the economy and all this. But whether or not that happens, all of these entities that previously had been purely local and civilian are going to be coordinated with the military. When I look at the word coordination, I can't help but see it in the German. The German word, which is a rough synonym for coordination, is Gleichschaltung. And that was used by the Nazis in 1936, basically, to describe this process of coordination where everything was made to mesh very tightly with all the gears of the ruling party and the military and secret police apparatus. And that's exactly what's going on right now. This bill is about American Gleichschaltung, about American coordination. And that word from the German actually has the connotation of gears being meshed together. And so whether or not you end up with these people actually being herded into these camps, later on the bill it talks about how they would be assigned to the various FEMA administrative regions, at least six of them. There are 10 FEMA administrative regions or districts throughout the country. I suspect that they start with six. They want to have 10 of them. Take a look at a FEMA map. If you get a hold of it, it's a little bit difficult to find, but there are these 10 FEMA administrative regions. It happens. I'm in Region 10. The Northwest, Idaho, Oregon, and Washington are Region 10. Region 9 is California, Nevada, and Arizona. Region 8 is the Rocky Mountain West. That's Utah, Colorado, Wyoming, Nevada, and the two Dakotas. Region 6 is Texas, New Mexico, Oklahoma, Louisiana, and Arkansas. And then number 7 is the Midwest. Number 5 is Chicago up to Canada. Number 6 is the Southeast. Number 3 is the area that includes Philadelphia, West Virginia, Virginia, and the District of Columbia. Number 2 is New York City. Number 1 is New England. I suspect that each one of those will eventually have some kind of a facility of the sort we're talking about, probably a pretty major undertaking. This may very well be part of the next stimulus bill. The big infrastructure program that we'll be talking about will be building these emergency response facilities. And on that subject, just very quickly, it's really interesting to me that the Defense Department is now talking about a civilian expeditionary workforce that would be part of the military once again. I have to tip my hat to Steve Watson. I believe he's a British writer over at Infowars.net. He works with the Alex Jones media network, and he's the one who brought this to my attention. The civilian expeditionary workforce according to the press release from the Pentagon, will be trained and equipped to deploy overseas in support of military missions worldwide. Overseas duty tours shall not exceed 2 years. Employees in deployable designated positions will be trained, equipped, and prepared to serve overseas in support of humanitarian, reconstruction, and, if absolutely necessary, combat support missions. Defense civilians reassigned from their normal duty to serve overseas will be granted the right to return to the positions they held prior to the deployment or to a position of similar grade, level, and responsibility within the same organization. That's basically housekeeping. But the point of this is, one of the things that Mr. Obama talked about during the campaign was the creation of a national security, civilian national security force. And now by executive order through the Defense Department, they're creating a civilian expeditionary force. I don't think that this is going to be a standalone measure. There's very serious talk about creating a universal national service template.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment. Well, William, got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
All right. Just to round off the thought that I was just discussing here, there's serious discussion of creating a template for universal national service, where at age 18, every American would be required to submit for 2 years of government-assigned duty, either in the military or in some commensurate form of service, whether it's for homeland security here or whether it's for some kind of civilian duty with the military abroad. I believe this is the first step in that program. And I think that it's interesting that they're talking about building these facilities nationwide, supposedly for the purpose of emergency response, the housing of people dislocated by some kind of emergency or disaster. But they're talking about using them as a permanent training facility for the first responders and for other civilian entities that would be working with the military. So I believe that when these bases are completed, they're going to be used not only perhaps as detention centers for those who are incorrigible, like yourself and myself, but also induction and indoctrination centers for those who are part of this national security, the civilian national security force. That would be one explanation. It certainly is an explanation that would fit the available facts, but I think the larger and more important point is that they're busily planning our future, and the future they're planning for us involves turmoil, upheaval, probable civil unrest and insurrection, and a great deal more of the type of authoritarianism that we've started to see under the Bush administration. We're going to see that escalate under the Obama reign. So by all means, people need to get ready. They need to fortify themselves intellectually and spiritually as well as physically for the times that we're living in. We have to get closer to God. That's an imperative. We have to steel our wills for some very hard decisions that will confront us. We should make ourselves financially and materially independent to the extent that we can. We need to get closer to God. We need to get closer to our families. And we need to be willing to stand and confront the people who are going to take everything that we treasure from us if we permit them to.
Well, I agree with you. We're moving into some very, very difficult times. But, of course, we've been anticipating this really for many years, and now it's finally upon us. And, of course, what we want to do and what we must do and what you out in the listening audience can do is not only make your preparations of spiritually and physically, but help us reach the people out across America. And you know, your job is to tell them that you can't make them believe, but believe me, they're going to remember what you said, and as times grow worse, and I can promise you they're going to go worse, they're going to remember what you said. Well, William, thank you so very much for being with us, and certainly we hope everything progresses well next week. Do you think you'll be able to do any radio programs, or should we hold off on them?
I think I'd be able to make myself available next Friday.
Okay, very good. God bless.
Bye-bye. God bless.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course that was William Grigg. As always, we enjoy having him with us on our Fridays, and hopefully we can get him on sometimes during the week. Well, this is the time I need to remind all of our listeners out across America that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we're dependent upon you to help us as we try to reach out across America by radio and by shortwave and by Internet and by satellite with the message of the truth and not only what's going on from a fiscal point of view, from a financial point of view, but also what's going on from a spiritual point of view, because there are powerful spiritual forces at work. If you have not yet seen our DVDs on The final countdown, Pastor Billy Crone, Part 1 and Part 2, or to get them together, why, of course, they're less expensive, or his talks on creation, Part 1, Part 2, each one with 5 DVDs in it, 5 sermons. But he has a lot of videos there, a lot of things that really make it much easier to watch and much more educational, and we recommend them to you. We've watched them all. And then, of course, we need to get this great new DVD we have. It's called The Eye of the Phoenix. The Eye of the Phoenix. It goes into the symbology on the back of the dollar bill. It's 2 hours and 50 minutes. It goes into the Roosevelt administration that put those emblems on the back of the dollar bill. And their occult foundation, and certainly the occult foundation of the Secretary of Agriculture, Henry Wallace, who was deeply involved in the occult and theosophy and masonry. And, of course, he and Franklin Delano Roosevelt put this occult emblem on the back of the dollar bill to demonstrate, of course, that America was moving into a new time, a new deal, as it were. And the Novus Ordo Seclorum lists, which is recounted at the back of the dollar bill underneath the Great Pyramid, they said that's the new deal. Well, that's what we're getting today, is another new deal, where all power is going to Washington. They're going to strengthen the federal government. They're going to establish a police state, of course, so that we'll be able to get through this difficult economic time that has been specifically created to bring about a new world order. And if you doubt that, you, of course, need to read my November and December newsletters. They're up on the Internet at RadioLiberty.com. RadioLiberty.com. You can get our books and certainly the DVD, The Eye of the Phoenix, at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. But go to our website and, of course, read my November and December Radio Liberty letters, and we'll have the January letter out in the near future. There's no question they knew it was coming down. They've done everything they can to prolong it. They are not addressing anything. They're trying to give you the impression they're trying to do something, but that is not their intent. What is their intent? Well, Henry Kissinger laid it out in his article in the International Herald Tribune, January 12th of 2009. Henry Kissinger, International Herald Tribune, January 12th, 2009. The opportunity for a new world order. And you need to get that article, you need to read it, and you need to understand this is all contrived. It is designed to destroy the economy of every nation in the world, and to impoverish people throughout the world, and to bring suffering to the world and chaos to the world, as the alternative, of course, is to establish this new economic order, this new international order, that the people within the covert organizations like the CFR and the Trilateral Commission and the Bilderbergers and the group of 30, but also the Masons and the Rosicrucians and the Theosophists and the Family and of course all of the occult organizations have always wanted to accomplish. You must understand there are powerful spirits and forces behind everything going on today. If you haven't read Brotherhood of Darkness or seen my talk on the Forbidden Secret, you need to get it. Go to our website, look at the things we have. Things you won't get elsewhere. You want to know how they killed General Patton? The book is Target Patton. You want to know how they killed Sidney Martin Luther King? The 4-CD set on the assassination of Martin Luther King. You know, want to know how they planned to kill all our boys on the USS Liberty back in 67? The 4-tape set on the Liberty or the Liberty special. And then Pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty.